Welcome to Talking Beats with Daniel Lelchuk. We hope you'll subscribe and give us a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Now, if you like the show, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. We believe now more than ever in providing a platform for individuality, free thought, and a diverse range of views. By supporting the show this way, you'll get early access to episodes, bonus episodes, and much, much more. Remember, the conversation is always active at Talking Beats Podcast on social media. Here's Daniel Lelchuk.
On today's program, star poker player Eric Seidel. He's won 8 World Series of Poker bracelets and a World Poker Tour title. In 2010, he was inducted into the Poker Hall of Fame. His total live tournament winnings exceed $35 million, and he's the only person to have won more than $5 million multiple years in a row. Of course, I didn't want to just sit down with him and ask him how to play poker, how to win money at the poker table. I knew he had a broad range of interests. He happens to be a great music lover. He happens to know a lot about music, which I knew going into this, but I think it might surprise you. His curiosity and his passion for fields well beyond poker are fascinating, and I'm thrilled he's joining me right now. Eric Seidel, welcome to you.
It's good to be here.
So there's a lot of things I'd like to ask you, but the first thing is, if you could give your own personal definition of poker, we can look it up online, we can read about it. What is poker to you?
Well, it's a variety of different games that have been played for a very long time. I'm not sure quite how long. And it's a game that mixes chance and skill in a way that is very interesting and compelling, and I think can keep people's focus for, in my case, most of my lifetime.
How did you first get into poker? You played other games before. You were on Wall Street, but you've talked before about sort of discovering poker as a kid and being given a book and suddenly shooting past all of the kids in your grade and all that.
Yeah, that was actually backgammon that I played in high school. And I ended up being a professional backgammon player, but I did find a book, Paul McGrill's book, which was the Bible of the game, and read it, and it put me ahead of all the kids at my school. And we were playing for a little bit of money, which was, a lot of money in high school. And, I was just trying to make, enough money to treat myself to a banana splits for lunch and that kind of thing. So I was a backgammon player up until maybe my mid-20s. And I was a little familiar with the poker scene, but I had played a few times in high school and I was just terrible, which is really funny. And I was the worst person in the game for sure. Then I went out to Las Vegas to play a backgammon tournament. And while I was out there, I bought a pamphlet by David Skolansky that was a $2 pamphlet that told you the basics of how to play poker. And that was what got me started. I was at the Dunes Hotel, played in a little game first couple days. I played for 2 days while I was there. And I won, $50, $55, something like that. And it was just that, that's the worst thing that can happen to you is winning the first time you play. Because then you're hooked. But I do love the game.
How do you think you went from being the worst to the best? I mean, it's kind of funny that you were bad in high school, and obviously now you're rather good.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I think in high school the problem I had was the kids that I was playing with had already played the games, and they had a certain amount of experience, and I was going in new, and I knew nothing. And so I it is surprising to me even now how bad I was. I'd only played a few weeks with them. But then what happened was we were playing in New York at a club called the Mayfair Club, which is a legendary backgammon and bridge club and developed into a poker club. For the first year of the game, no professionals were allowed in the game. So it gave me a chance to develop among people that, you know, were my equals at the time. We were all pretty bad players. And there were a couple of decent players in the game that we could learn from. And that was just kind of how it developed. I got very interested in it because it just seemed like such a cool challenge to take on. And such a, you know, I did know a few people who played it and played it well. And it was just kind of fun to engage with it. You know, it was just kind of a challenge.
One of the great things that we're always taught and we always practice in music is to play with the best people you can, to play with people who are better than you, and there's no greater education and no greater way to fast track your own musical improvement than being on stage with people who are better. And that's something that the great clarinetist Artie Shaw talked about rather funnily, because he said, I always tried to play with people who were better than me, and then I stopped being able to find people better than me, so I stopped playing with anybody.
That's funny. Yeah,
is it like that with poker, though?
Yes, I think you do need to play with better players in order to improve. And I was fortunate because at the Mayfair, after about a year, they opened it up to some professionals, and they were really excellent players, people like Dan Harrington and Howard Lederer. They were very good players. They were experienced players. And so now there was a mix of amateurs and good players, people that you could learn from. And it was very helpful to be able to watch them, but still be able to play with people who, weren't that skilled.
How do you practice for a match? What do you study? What can you study? Do you look in the mirror? Is it face? Is it brain? I mean,
that's changed a lot over the years. It used to be, up until very recently, you were studying by playing. You were just you would play and then you'd play the next day, and you know, eventually you'd start figuring things out. Now that computers have come into the game, it's really changed things. So people have much more specific answers to questions, you know, in terms of what, how the bet hands, what hands to open with, how to respond to certain openings, when to respond to certain openings. And it's become a lot more complex and a lot more, it's a game that takes a lot of work now. Whereas you used to just be able to show up. So that's been an interesting transition. I would say that's happened over the last 3 or 4 years. And it's created a real challenge for, you know, people like me who just were used to getting up in the morning and showing up for work. Now it takes some preparation.
How come you can't do that? Who says you have to have anything to do with computerized poker? And is this with a machine or with another person online?
Well, it can be both. They do have online games that you can play, and you can record, and you can study, and then they also have software that people play with, and people get parameters from, there are a lot of people spending a lot of time studying on computers, you know, which does, you know, it makes it very challenging for somebody like me, because there are younger, you know, people who are much younger than I am, people who are much smarter than I am, working very hard every day to get great at the game. And so the level of play is unquestionably much higher now, significantly. It's hard to put in percentages, but it's an entirely different game now than it was 4 years ago.
Wait, you think people are actually better?
People are much better, yeah. Yeah.
Why? Because they can practice more?
Yeah, because they're they're learning from computer software, and the software is telling them things that we didn't know before. So, and there's a lot to poker. There's just a lot of very, very difficult for somebody to, you know, even the most elite players still make very big mistakes. There's so much uncertainty there. You know, some of it comes down to guesswork. You know, you have certain things you know, but you don't know this exact situation, and so you just have to estimate. It's entirely different now. And I mean, there's still, you know, most people who are playing tournaments and most people who are playing poker aren't dealing with that. They can continue to play the way the game used to be played. I'm talking about playing at the tournaments that are at the highest levels, the high roller tournaments, are mostly fields of people who have put in a lot of work.
What's happening with you right now? Are you in the midst of something? Are you preparing for something? How competitive do you feel right now, 2021?
Well, it's been a long time off. I guess it's been about 14 months since I've played live, and I'm kind of chomping at the bit to get back to it. There is a tournament in Florida at the Hard Rock, and so I'm excited to go down there and play.
So that's going to be your first tournament in more than a year?
I'm looking forward to the feeling of just being in a poker room and being among people and getting to play again. You know, every time you sit down at the table, you're kind of testing yourself and you're seeing it. Do you still have, you know, is the thought process working this time? So it's, you know, it's going to be very different to be able to sit down and actually play cards and with a bunch of other people.
And this is a high stakes tournament, yeah?
Yeah, there are two high rollers. The first one is a $50,000 buy-in, and there's another one for $25,000. And then there's one for $3,500. And each of those tournaments has rebuys. So if you're playing and you lose before maybe the first 6 or 9 hours, I'm not sure exactly, you can rebuy. So a $50,000 tournament could easily be a $200,000 tournament. you get multiple chances if you want them.
So you mentioned before about the idea that you sit down and you see if your thought process is still there. What could go wrong? It's just a bad judgment call? Is it? What is your biggest fear of a breakdown in the thought process?
It takes a lot of focus and energy and concentration. So I would say that the concerns that I have going into tournaments is, will I have the energy? Will I have the focus? And, you know, and also, will I be able to apply the things that, you know, I have to make sure I'm not rusty. Will I be able to apply the things that that I know? And for it takes a certain amount of mental agility, because the landscape is always changing. Depending on who you're playing with and what their chip counts are, and there's so many different variants that come in. Yeah, there's always the question of, you know, hopefully I can do this again. You know, it's definitely not the kind of job where you show up and you can just kind of go through the motions and do well. I mean, particularly in the high roller events, you're playing with the best players in the world. So you really, really have to be on top of your game. And if you're anything less than that, you're going to be at a disadvantage.
Well, it's very similar to music, when there's always this question of you can't phone it in. You have to be there. You have to be fully present when you're on stage playing a concert.
Yeah, exactly.
I was thinking, you know, the first thing when I was reading about you, and of course I'd known your name for a while, and your last name, Seidel, I am sure you're aware of the great old Russian violinist Tasha Seidel, who was a very, very famous player. He died in the 60s.
Actually, I wasn't aware of him, no. The only famous Seidel I was aware of is that there's a poet. I think it's Fred Seidel, and I think he lives in my neighborhood too.
Where in New York or in Las Vegas?
Yeah, I live in Vegas, but we have an apartment in New York.
I see. I see. So the poet doesn't live in Vegas.
He does not, no. I don't think we have too many poets in Vegas, unfortunately. Need to import some.
Well, this violinist, it was the first thing I saw, first thing I thought of when I saw your name, Tascha, Toscha, Tascha Seidel, was one of the great violinists, one of the group of pioneering Russian Jewish violinists who took the music world by fire, by storm, and changed the history of music making.
Wow, that's really cool to hear. I'll definitely check him out.
You're big into music, aren't you?
I am. I love music, yeah. I mean, I listen to all kinds of music. I don't know. Did you see this clip from the Dudamel was conducting a youth orchestra in Caracas? Like a 2-minute clip was online yesterday and the day before. It's the most exciting. It looked like it would have been the musical event of your life if you had been there. It was so exuberant and so exciting. And I actually tweeted it a couple of days ago because it gives you an idea of how incredible it can be to be, to be in the audience and to participate, well, in a musical event, and also how exciting classical music can be. It's really an incredible piece if you haven't seen it.
I don't think I've seen that specific one. What were they playing?
They were playing something from West Side Story.
Probably the suite from West Side Story by Bernstein, of course. One of the great That's one of the great treasures of the repertoire, this orchestral suite taken from the entire production, of sort of orchestral medley. It's a wonderful piece, and Dudamel always does great Bernstein.
Yeah, I'd love to see the whole concert. It just to see a 2-minute clip and see how exciting that 2 minutes was. It just makes you wonder what the entire concert was like.
I'm glad you said that classical music can be exciting. I mean, you don't need to sell me on that idea, but some people have this sort of it's just simply wrong image of a stiff and buttoned up and an ultra formalistic experience, when it's actually quite the opposite. It's freeing, it's fiery, and it's all the passions running white hot on stage, especially when there's a live audience. It's pretty hard to do over the computer screen, which is why I pretty much do none of that myself.
Well, it's probably like with anything, is that the more people know about it, the more they're exposed to it, the more they'll like it and enjoy it. And it can be for somebody like me who doesn't have the background and doesn't know the difference between the composers. There's a lot to take in, and which is great. But when you have a certain amount of exposure to it, I would imagine it's even more enriching.
How'd you get into music in the first place? How'd you get to love music?
I was really an awkward kid, and when I was a kid, I would just play a lot of music because it was the company. I didn't socialize that much, so I spent a lot of time just listening to music, and music just meant so much to me. And it still means a lot to me. It's still I'm just astounded at how many gifted people there are producing music. And that was one of the things that I've missed in the last year, was not really being able to see anything live.
A few nights ago, right now I'm speaking to you from Castleton, Virginia, where the great late orchestral conductor Lorin Maazel has a wonderful theater that he built. And the first concert here was in 1997 with him playing violin and Yefim Bronfman playing piano and Mstislav Rostropovich playing cello. And since then, all these great players have been here, and we have a chamber series here. And we played the first concert with people, 30% capacity, but it sold out instantly. And that was a few nights ago. And it was an unbelievable feeling to look out and actually see people. And and play for people who were there responding. And the difference between that and just playing for cameras and microphones is stunning.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I mean, I'm only on the other side of it, but we went to see our first concert in over a year the other day at the City Winery in New York, Steve Earle. And there's just something so special about being there and being, you know, getting to watch. It's also an incredible venue. If you're in New York and you have the opportunity, it's worth seeing anything at City Winery. They have a new venue and it's just unbelievable.
It's like an outdoor stage or what?
It's indoors. It's on the Hudson. They had a nice venue downtown on Varick Street, and the building got taken over by Disney or something, so they had to move. And they got this really incredible space on the Hudson River. I'm not sure what the building is. Maybe it's a bus depot or something. it's just a huge government building. And they got this corner of it, and they just did an absolutely incredible job fixing it up. It's a complete contrast to the actual building, which looks like, you know, some kind of a rundown government building from years ago. But they've done, it looks out on the water. The sound system is just fantastic. There's just not a bad seat in the entire place. And they put some great people. They have Sinead O'Connor. They have we saw Lauryn Hill there. This was at the smaller venue. Now this venue is a bit bigger, so they'll probably be able to book even bigger artists. Really worth a trip for anybody who's stopping by New York.
You are sort of well known for not liking to sort of ruminate and wax solemnly about your methods on the poker table. Why is it that you don't like to talk about methods and strategies particularly, and why did you take on this interesting project with Maria Konnikova to sort of teach her? What was the attraction there?
Well, I think I did get that reputation. I didn't like showing, when TV first came around, I didn't like showing my cards. It was a few things, I guess. I was uncomfortable. I just felt uncomfortable playing on TV. And I, you know, in some ways, I guess I thought I was playing in a way that I didn't necessarily want people to see. I just thought that poker is a game where you want to give as little information about what you're capable of, and you know, maybe at the time I felt like I was playing a certain way that I didn't necessarily want to be broadcast, that was many years ago, and now you just have to accept that it's all being televised and you have to play. So Maria got in touch with me a few years ago, and she had this idea that she wanted to go from knowing absolutely nothing about poker to playing. I think maybe the end game at the time was to play the World Series, and just to see how good a player she could become. I was just intrigued by the whole idea of the project. She certainly has a certain amount of charm. Her approach was more in line with the way my thinking was. She was coming from a background of psychology, it just seemed to me like this was really going to be a fun project, and I thought it would be fun to be involved. And I also have so much respect for people who, she's a writer from the New Yorker, and obviously many of the best writers in the world write for the New Yorker. So it just seemed like this just seemed like a fun project, and I didn't know what it would entail, and neither did she at the time. And the result, hopefully people will go out and read the book, because her journey was incredible. And she ended up winning a major tournament along the way, and still loves the game, which it's so nice for me to hear that she wants to continue the play, and she plans on continuing the play tournaments, and she worked very, very hard to get good at the game. It was very impressive and somewhat inspiring to see how much effort she put into it. And it turned out, you know, I started off coaching her and helping her. And I would say at this point, there are things that she's added to my game, just because she was out there, you know, working on some of the software and stuff that I hadn't worked with.
Talk about the idea of studying. So here we are, let's take chess as an example. There's all these scenarios, all these playbooks that chess players study and memorize all the sequences and hundreds of thousands of combinations and where this can go, what happens if you do this. Poker's very different. What is there that you want to study that Maria Konnikova wanted to study? If you said you need to go study this and come back to me in a week, what would the this have been?
Well, it would depend at what point in her progression that we were talking about. At the very beginning, it was, you know, read a few books. There's a great book by Dan Harrington that she read early on. I think that was very helpful to her. And then once she got beyond that, a lot of it was just playing one tournament after another, and then coming back and discussing hands and, you know, looking at individual hands and how they were played and what mistakes she made, if any. Well, I mean, all of us make mistakes every time we sit down to play. And then now, you know, she's evolved into a good enough player that a lot of the work that she would do now would involve software where she can look things up and she can try and get answers from that. She literally didn't know how many cards were in the deck to where she is now, where you can really talk to her about very complex ideas, and she has a really good understanding of the game. I'm excited to see, you know, the next few years, how, you know, watch her play some tournaments and see how it goes. And I think she's been a real asset to the poker world. And I think the book and the story of the book has been a really positive thing for poker.
I'll be sure to ask her about it. I think she's coming on here in a few months.
Oh, that's great. So that's good to hear.
So I will certainly ask her how she got you to go along with all of this from her point of view. I guess we've had your few impressions. There's sort of a fundamental underlying question to all of this that probably people are thinking about. I'm certainly thinking about, which is the power of observation, the power of you sitting there at a table with other people, looking at them and calculating and making conjectures and wondering, what do you think when you're looking around the table? What do you look for? I mean, obviously at the highest levels of poker, you're not sort of dealing with people who aren't in control of their face, of their body.
Yeah, it's true. In the really big events, you don't necessarily get too many physical tells, but you're looking for patterns of people's betting. You're looking for maybe somebody gives something away physically. And then you're also very often people are trying to give off false tells. And so you have to try and figure out, is this a false tell? Is this person actually nervous? Or are they just pretending to be nervous? It's it's a fun part of the game. And there's nothing like, you know, there's the movie Rounders where, what is the tell? The guy is like rubbing two Oreos or something. I forget exactly what it is, but there isn't any easy tell from anyone. It's been years since I saw one that was really obvious. Definitely at the top levels, you are fooled quite often because people aren't really giving anything away physically. People used to be are a lot less aware of their physical tells, and it used to be a much bigger part of the game, maybe even the dominant part of the game for a while, no limit if you were playing somebody. But I think those days are past.
If there's no physical tells, how do you win? How does anybody excel? if there's no cues?
Well, some of it is just technical knowledge, and some of it is a certain amount of reading. And I wouldn't say there are no tells, but there are some. There are some players that are not professionals that are playing in tournaments. And so that pretty much drives the tournament scene, is that not everyone in the tournament is an elite player. Even if it's a very high percentage, it's often, you know, it can be 80 or 90%. But there still are people who enjoy the challenge of playing against the best players. And the brilliance of poker is that you can be a rank amateur and you can go home with the trophy because there is enough luck. And also many of the amateurs have really upped their games. So they may not be super elite players. There are plenty of amateurs that you could take now that would be dominant players 15 years ago if they could go back because of the acceleration of knowledge in the last 15, 20 years.
It is amazing what the acceleration of knowledge, as you call it, and the dominance of computers and the amount of information out there has absolutely changed everything in the entire world. I mean, kudos for having kept up in a way. I mean, you're not ancient, but you're not a 30-year-old either.
Yeah, I mean, I went through it before because when I was a backgammon player, which was let's say 35 years ago, computers solved backgammon long before they ever entered poker, at least 30 years before they entered poker, and so. To the very end of my career, computers were coming in. You know, basically somebody could sit in their closet and, for 6 months and just play on a computer and develop skills that I had worked many years to get. So I had gone through it before with the with how backgammon had changed. It's really affected pretty much everything. Computers have advanced our knowledge in just about every area.
What are you looking forward to other than the upcoming tournament? Is that, this must be something long time coming, first time in 14 months, around the table with other folks down. And where is it down in Florida?
It's in a town called Davies, which is near Fort Lauderdale. And it's actually a pretty cool hotel. The hotel is shaped like a guitar. I don't know if you've seen it, but look it up if you haven't, because it's great. It's a great looking hotel.
I will look. I like anything shaped like a musical instrument, or including musical instruments. when you think about the location, I mean, is it fun just to be around the hotels and the people? I mean, do you always stay at the hotel where you play? Is it must be kind of fun in that respect if you like hotels.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed that. I mean, one of the things that the poker tournament scene provides is a chance to see the world. And this was true somewhat of backgammon as well. You travel around to international tournaments. And, obviously you get to do that also. But it's not to be taken for granted. It's just to have the opportunity to spend time and be in all these incredible cities and all these incredible places. And poker tournaments do tend to be very often in, we have one in Monte Carlo. Sometimes we get to play in London. I think there's one coming up in Dubai. You really get to go to a lot of interesting spots. Australia is an amazing part of the tour. Last year, we got to play in Melbourne. And fortunately, I love traveling, and I really missed it this year. I can't complain too much about this year because I got to spend it with my two daughters. But I look forward to going on trips and checking out different restaurants and being in different cultures and seeing people that I haven't seen in a while.
You're preaching to the choir, and one of the at dinner with a couple of folks last night, and I was sort of lamenting, there are many things to lament about the past year, and I've had it I've had it better than 99% of people in the world, so I'm not sort of, you know, complaining in a woe is me sense. But from a social standpoint, what are the things we've lost? I hope we regain is the idea of spontaneity, or, you know, running into someone in the hallway, or sitting down at a restaurant and someone sees you from across the room and you strike up a conversation, and how this has forced everything to be so planned and so predetermined. If you, am I going to see you, or we will stay 6 feet apart, or are you vaccinated? I mean, the spontaneity that makes life so wonderful.
It was a tough, yeah, I'm sure. I would imagine it's very similar with you, because you're used to going to, you know, I don't know how much of the year are you traveling?
Well, I play about 100 concerts with the symphony each year, and then I also do a fair amount of traveling, a lot during the summer and other international places all the time. And I just love being on planes, and I love being in foreign places. I love being in new restaurants, and it gives me energy. Some people are worn down by the travel, but for me, it pumps me up and makes me feel very energetic.
I've always felt that, you know, if you can take children traveling, you know, especially outside the country, and they can experience different cultures, that type of exposure for them is more valuable than even school is.
Having the ability to interact with people from other cultures, especially as a young person, is irreplaceable. It's not something you can reproduce in the classroom or reproduce by watching a YouTube video. The fact, you know, placing your 10-year-old daughter, whatever, in Paris and saying, oh, we're going to go get a coffee now, let's see how this works. I mean, you can't reproduce it. It's important for the development of people, I think, to interact with people who are different.
Yes, exactly. Really is important.
Eric Seidel, give us some good music to go out on. I've given you a recommendation for you to go listen to your non-relative Tasha Seidel, the violin player.
I'm claiming
give us some recommendations so we've finished listening to you here, and then we're going to go online and listen to what?
Valerie June is incredible. I've been listening to her a lot lately. There's a gal, Frazzy Ford, who I really like. Here's a guy who it seems to me, I don't understand how he's been so under the radar for so much of his career. Joseph Arthur, who I think is one of the most gifted singer-songwriters around. He's also an artist, and I see him at every opportunity that I can. He's a fun live performer. I would say somebody, you know, people could listen to him. Where I'm Coming From is one album of his that I really love. The musical world is so rich. There are so many. I mean, I have a playlist on Spotify that has 1,000 songs on it, because there's so many different and diverse artists that you can listen to now. I think I always hear people say, like, that music isn't as good now as it used to be, but I don't see that as being true either. I mean, in any way, it seems like there are tons of really gifted people. A friend of mine who's a singer actually sent me something yesterday that I really loved. Her name was Noga Erez, Nogaerez. She wasn't an artist that I was familiar with, but every song I heard of hers yesterday was beautiful.
Wow, very young. She's 31 years old.
Yeah. I think she has 3 or 4 albums now. I haven't had a chance to listen to all of them, but I'm looking forward to it.
And she sings in Hebrew, yeah? It seems it from my Googling right now, but maybe not.
I mean, the songs that I heard were not in Hebrew.
Okay.
Or maybe they were. I don't know. She's, but I would love to, if you want to send me your top 5 album picks, I would love to listen to them.
Absolutely. They change almost by the day. But I'll send you what's on my mind right now. Sure. Eric Seidel, look, with all the best wishes for the upcoming tournament at that fabulous hotel, which I just looked up. It is incredible. The Guitar
Beautiful Hotel. Yeah.
With all the best wishes for that, and with gratitude for being here, it was pretty illuminating, and I thank you.
Okay, it's good to be here.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. The original theme music is by Ronald Barkham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse, and Doug Christian is executive producer. We invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can support us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. And be sure to check us out on social media. We'll see you next time on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk.